Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews.
By students, for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, everybody. It's Dave Etler, and I'm here with John Pienta.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm here with Mark Torrell.
What's up?
Torrell?
Torrell.
Torrell?
Yeah.
Fantastic. I'm here with Nick Spar.
Yep.
And Casey McCleary.
How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. It's been an eventful week here at the Carver College of Medicine. I know that...
Not for me.
I know that you guys, or many of you guys... Let's see. John, Urith, too. Sort of.
Yeah, we're on our way up.
You're MSTP, so you know. I don't know.
I'm still part of you guys.
Mark's in permanent limbo.
I don't know what Mark does. He goes and he researches, but pretty much he has all his time free. I think, right?
Yeah, few new now.
Nick is a two.
Well, am I a two now?
I don't. Well,
we were calling ourselves two now, so I
you're
think
almost
you
a
need
two.
To.
Okay, then I'm a three.
So and Casey, of course, is now a two. And so you guys have, it's kind of quiet for you guys, but for me, it's been an eventful week because I've been working on starting the medical student performance evaluations for residency. And I think we've talked about it a little bit on the show, but I have a problem. And that is that it's an evaluation. It's not a recommendation, but it doesn't matter. People come to me and say, hey, Dave, you know, I've looked at my first draft and this says I'm good, and I'd rather it say that I'm excellent. Can you fix that for me?
You'd like it to kiss your ass more.
Can you fix that for me, Dave?
No, I can't fix that for you. You're the thing I want people to know. This is
I could fix that for you if you were actually excellent.
Yes,
but you're not.
Ooh. Yes, well, I mean, you know, you may in fact be excellent. It's just not what the comment said. You know, like I can't change somebody else's. I can change it a little bit. Like I can change it if they don't know how to write, then I can change it so that it's more clear. But if they said you were good and you wanted to say you're excellent, no, I can't change that. But the point I'm trying to make here is that, and I don't think we do a good enough job. Maybe we don't do a good enough job during clinical beginnings, in telling people you are about to write your own MSPE. Okay. You are about to go off into the clinics and show off your skills, show off, how you learn. More importantly, show off how you learn because nobody really expects you when you go to, I don't think anybody expects you really when you go to the clinics to be all, you know, doctory, right?
At least not perfect, I hope.
No, I mean, you've got some sort of basic ideas, but you know, everybody acknowledges, I think, that you have a lot to learn. Right?
I'd hope so.
Yeah. Here's what I find in the comments that is most the best comments I see are things like, you know, he or she is teachable. All right. So in other words, you and takes good feedback and does something with it and is mature, professional, you know, it's nice to see progress in learning, you know, like, I hate the word improve though. I often change the word improve to increase.
Why?
Because I feel like, you know, while I understand improve mean, you know, is a good thing, like you are improving your skill. It sort of to me has a connotation of like, you know, they kind of sucked and now they're better.
There are certain ways of getting the words to say other things. You kind of become a master of massage, of data massage.
But I want to be clear. Like my intent isn't to make people who are not good seem better.
Yeah,
I don't want to. I don't want to bias anybody in the wrong. Okay.
What is your actual job? Do you like compile all the clinical comments?
Any monkey can do it. It's basically taking all of the data from like 20 different places and putting it all into one document. So that it's, you know, clear and presentable and makes a certain amount of sense. And you know, where we can, we, you know, I try to advocate, but you know, I can't change the mediocre to the good. That's mm-hmm. that's sort
well,
of your job.
If you're altering the spectrum, it kind of defeats the purpose of giving any of those descriptors.
Yeah.
If you're going to just be changing things from good to excellent or bad to okay.
I will say the doctors are terrible writers.
Yeah.
You guys need to up your game.
Well,
John's going to be fine. John's going to write poetry.
There's a great one.
Haikus.
There's a great idea. So, you know, basically the way to say this person sucked is to say, I recommend them. Instead of saying, I highly recommend them, or, you know, I highly recommend them, and here's the reason why they are, like, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread.
It is very subtle.
And so there are...
You do have to be a bit subtle.
There are ways of making the words say things that they don't actually say, but it's like, it's marketing. It's a marketing
I'm not
going
to say recommend, though, if I don't recommend them. I'm going to say this person, or, you know, if I was writing a recommendation letter for somebody, I think I would be very, first of all, I'd be very careful because I don't want to get sued. Right?
A thing that they can do?
I think, well, in the employment world.
Golly.
It is, I think.
We just mm-hmm. want to sue everybody.
But I would probably say something like, does excellent work under guidance or something like that. Would be the kiss of death.
As opposed to independence.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the kiss of death, that reminds me of, and I think we maybe touched on this a little bit when Keenan was here.
But I had to edit so much of that episode, I have no idea what it says anymore.
Keenan and I, well,
I want to say that was a Herculean task.
You could get Keenan to say anything you want now with that editing job. He talks so fast, you now have, like, every phoneme, yeah. So you can just morph his words.
Like Jerry Seinfeld episodes.
Yeah, there's an episode of 30 Rock where they just make Seinfeld say anything they want. They can add him in because they have so many clips of him that they can reassemble it and put him into any television show they want now.
That's just one episode for Keenan.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that all it took was one episode to get that much data. But the is the idea the kiss of death of the word unprofessional? Because, like, I could say, let's say I say Mark is unprofessional in clinic. Now, does that mean that Mark maybe once spoke out of turn, or maybe I didn't eat a ham sandwich for lunch and I was upset, and so, you know, the way that Mark interjected a comment maybe made the resident a little miffed or something. But unprofessional could also mean that he showed up to clinic and dropped his pants in clinic, you know, like, and you know, mm-hmm. it could mean that he hit on patient's wife.
It's very,
you know,
unprofessional,
right?
Dropping your pants in clinic.
Exactly.
Did they cover that in Clinical Beginnings? I guess under appropriate dress.
We'll let you know.
If they do, that means someone has done it before. It's that kind of weird obscure thing when they go out of their way to say, like, now you can't do X thing.
Boys,
you know,
are,
somebody did that, and that's why they
right,
have to bring it
boys
up.
Boys are not allowed to wear kilts to clinic.
Is that what they said? Did
you
they
now,
say that?
You now know that you now know that at least one boy has worn a kilt to clinic.
Can girls wear kilts? Because I would wear a utility kilt to clinic.
Go for it.
You could keep all
depends
of your doctor
the
tools
the
in it.
Kilt.
How cool would that be?
Yeah, that's.
Oh my God! Why are people not doing this?
Utility kilts are the ultimate nerd.
Shut up.
Yeah, that you
the
know.
Ultimate nerd clothing.
I'm really not sure what category it falls
but see, the
in.
Thing okay. is, the thing is, I'm the thing about utility kilts, though, is I kind of want one, except I know I don't have the legs for it.
Oh, you know that's a valid concern.
High socks.
Yeah.
Ooh.
There are ways around it.
I do.
You have it again.
I have alopecia, so I have totally hairless legs. Immaculate legs.
John, you know what I love? Every week, you know, when I post, and you're on the show, and I post this show, I put your pictures at the bottom of the post on the blog, and John has this... John is like this hairy beast in the photo, in the only photo I have of you.
I literally had a hard time getting a comb through my hair.
Wow.
It was amusing.
Was that hard for you to lose your hair, or do you like it better this way? Or
it's certainly easier to get out of bed.
The like patches of hair loss when all my hair on my head was falling off made me look really mangy. So I think that was the only part that was really hard for me. But now I look at hair as like a vestigial organ, like something we have that
John,
you don't need.
John
it's
evolved.
Like, it's like the appendix of the skin.
The next stage.
I don't want to live in that world.
And now I get to like
Homo
make
hairless.
People make people feel really awkward when I use hair puns and stuff. Like I try to use hair puns as much as I can now.
There's some good ones.
Yeah, there. I mean, we really really we're splitting hairs here today.
John, I don't
all day with someone hairy should, situation. No, I have a good one. Oh, yeah, hairy situation is good. Yeah. I was going to say
there's a bunch. Don't get me started.
Couldn't someone consider that harassment?
Oh,
yeah, I had to get that out.
I just want, you know, for what it's worth, and it's worth nothing, John. I don't miss your hair at all.
Me neither.
I think you look like I think you look like you were born without hair, which you were.
We don't know that.
I've found
that if I wear sunglasses, I can intimidate people.
Yeah.
Because being bald, I think people maybe think you're inherently a little meaner. But I think it's also funny because on the flip side, when I'm in clinic and there's like kids, that it's really amusing because I look like some kind of clown or something.
Let him rub your head.
You did not look mean with hair. I can say that. Listeners, go to the website. Look at the picture at shortcoat.com. Look at the picture of John. He does not in any way look intimidating.
You could get
You're a redhead, so or you. Well,
you're a redhead.
I was some head.
Abandonment.
Some sort of
brownish blonde.
Red.
Some
don't you think?
Dirty blonde.
I did have red beard hair though. Pretty significant red facial hair.
Right. A lot of people have red beard hair. I don't know why that's
a
thing.
Yeah, like redheads.
But that is a thing. No, like everybody, like a lot of guys with brown hair have red beard hair.
I've noticed that too.
Like really distinctly red. And I really wonder what's up with that. Does anybody know?
The great medical mystery. Let's get an NIH grant.
Research project.
Howard Hughes Medical Institute will study it now.
A fellowship of rust colored hair.
Men's very hair psychologically research damaging. Is totally a thing.
Damaging.
I'm, as I've mentioned before on the show, losing my hair, and it's kind of annoying. Because I wish it would just go. You know, like if it's going to. You know, like in your case.
Just pack up and leave.
I don't care if I look funny for a while because I look funny all the time. I just wish it would like just jump off my head and be done with it.
Like there's this middle ground. My favorite is when
that's too much work.
My bad.
It is though. You know, like I hate shaving, as you can see.
Shaving the face and shaving the head are very different. Like if you touch the top of your head, you'll realize very quickly that the bone is very close to the scalp. And so,
you could easily rip your scalp right off.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, you can.
Is that what you're saying?
Oh. Yeah, I've done it several times.
But what if you have
And
a
your scalp
head?
Bleeds a lot. And my head is like a cube.
I've
got a lot of corners up there.
When I lived in New York a long time ago, we went to the shore house of somebody's and, you know, like the Jersey Shore. And we decided on a whim to give ourselves buzz cuts. You know, I did mine and I actually have a fairly, you know, round head like John's. It's a little bit more elongated, but at least the cranium is sort of a curve. Mm-hmm. And so my friend was like, oh, that looks great. And he went and shaved his head and it turns out he has a cone.
So
he was unhappy. So shout
well,
out.
Now he knows.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the benefit of having a shaved or buzz cut head is that you do look a little intimidating. So I would, you know, take the bus home from New York and wear my leather jacket. This is the early 90s, by the way. So please don't make any judgments about my choices. Leather jacket, acid wash jeans, and I would sit on the Greyhound bus and I would give myself crazy eyes on purpose so that people wouldn't sit next to me. Worked like a
brilliant
charm.
That's a good strategy.
But then, you know, once I saw that the bus was starting to fill up, then I would change my demeanor.
On bus rides back from college, I'd always pretend to be sleeping because I didn't know anyone on the bus, and no one's going to go wake up a stranger if there's any other seat available.
Actually, that's a good plan.
I'd almost always get double
less,
seats.
That's if less hostile than mine, more passive aggressive.
Did you sit on the aisle seat and then sleep so that they're like, they would think they'd have to get by you?
Oh, yeah.
Or,
oh, yeah.
Oh, nice.
No, I had,
good
and if
strategy.
I was really wanting another seat, I'd put in headphones too, because who's going to like wake up a stranger with headphones in to be like, hey, can I sit here when there's other seats available? No one's going to do it.
No, that's a good call.
Yeah.
And this is
good psychology.
I use that on when the city buses here too, because let's face it, when I'm riding a city bus, there are some people who I don't want to sit next to all the time.
That's fair.
You know?
I do that kind of
thing. They usually
have
lots of logos on their clothing, I've noticed too.
I do that kind of thing if I'm like walking home at night and I feel unsafe, I will do something that makes me look crazier than anyone who might want to attack me.
Like, whip out your nunchucks and start...
So the best example that I can think of was during Visha at Iowa State a couple years ago, and I know like that can get pretty crazy before it got canceled.
Wait, what's that?
Yeah,
it's a riot that they have every year.
It's our yearly spring celebration /riot. So it's supposed to celebrate the original colleges of Iowa State. It's supposed to celebrate like, the history of Iowa State, and there are tons of events, and like lots of parents and families come, and it's the official Visha is really, really fun, but we have this problem called unofficial Visha, which is where everybody goes out and drinks and acts stupid, and people come from other schools and then like get drunk and fall off of buildings. Mm. Someone literally fell off of a building, or like have sex on a car in the street in the middle of the day. That was just impressive.
That sounds like fun.
Stupidity. But I don't feel super safe walking outside during that week.
Nothing says history and celebration. Nothing says history and celebration of intellectual achievements than rioting and,
I know,
and
right?
sex on a car.
Yeah, no, the administration's not a big fan of unofficial Visha, and they got canceled because... because we keep having stupid riots from stupid people.
UMass used to have riots too. I remember the Southwest dorms. They're tower dorms, and they would, my wife was a police dispatcher, so I hear about stuff like this. But they would throw washing machines out of the building. Mm. They would,
good times.
They would, they would have their riots. I don't understand sports riots. Can somebody explain sports riots to me at all?
Well,
I mean, like you win, you riot. So, you lose, you riot. What's
that? So in Europe, it's a little different because it's around football or what we call soccer. And
they're just rioting in a different
and
language.
And it's usually started by hooligans. Now, a hooligan like is not the general term it means here. Hooligan are like very rough and tumble kinds of guys who maybe like shoot up heroin and then throw beer bottles and stuff at people.
That's like, oddly specific.
If you've seen the movie Trainspotting, it's not entirely wrong.
yeah, that was a long time ago.
That's ridiculous.
So that I think you're like, oh, okay, I can understand where that comes from. Somebody hit you in the back of the head with a beer bottle as hard as they could throw it. And then now you're in like a furious rage.
I guess I might riot in that case.
But yeah, I don't know.
Let's recap my advice to you people, okay? When you go to the clinics, be helpful. I think Keenan's actually, in the episode where he discussed this, I think he might have been just a little bit overboard on this. You should be helpful. Because if you're helping people do their jobs, then you're going to learn what their jobs are, right?
What did he say
exactly?
Could you refresh
them?
Remember.
So Keenan's big thing was that, Your goal really and the job should be to be there to learn, and that you've been in some situations you're being sort of impugned that what you need to be there to do is to really just kind of help out. And I think I see where he's coming from with that.
I could see that becoming excessive. Yes, like, oh, you didn't help me. I don't know.
Are they there as a med student or are they there as a nursing assistant that you know?
But you have to learn
that department doesn't have to pay for.
But don't you have to learn though?
No, it's not purely learning experience because you are being evaluated on your ability to adapt, your ability to learn, and a lot of these things like helping people, they extrapolate to say your ability to be a team player, your ability to work as part of a team, regardless of what and how minuscule your role might actually be.
That's right, because I don't have to like everything I do in my job, but a lot of what I do involves helping people, and even if I don't want to help them, I have to help them, right? But also, by helping, say, I don't know, start an IV or whatever, sort of whatever counts for manual labor in the world of physicians,
moving patients,
whatever, it does help you understand what the other parts of the team have to do, don't you think? I can see where it would go overboard, possibly, but
yeah, I think one thing with Keenan's advice is to take it with a slight amount of moderation, because I think Keenan is great at many things, but being moderate is not one of them.
God love him. Now that he's gone, we can talk about him.
Thank you, Keenan, for that opportunity.
Keenan, to be clear, Keenan,
we've got nothing but love for you.
We do have nothing but love for you. I know you were angry that day, and I had to edit I took out 15 minutes of that episode.
Oh my goodness.
We're mostly in agreement.
I don't even know if the portion about him like helping versus not helping. I don't even know if that.
Well,
like,
now people
survived.
Now people know what we're talking about. Yeah. So in case you did have to cut that totally out.
But anyway, yeah. So if you're helpful, people will appreciate you. If you show some judgment, people will appreciate you. If you know when not to, if you know when to be, if you have some humility, people will appreciate you. If you increase your knowledge, you will get good comments. If you what you don't have to do.
Wear your pants in clinic.
If you wear your pants in clinic.
I think it's important to remember to have thick skin with this stuff too, because I mean, a lot of it's so subjective. Some people just aren't going to like you just from the get-go, just because of minor...
Sounds like a man with experience.
Nobody likes me.
Aww.
But, yeah, it's okay. No, but it's a reality, though, that people are going to give you harsh criticism sometimes, even when you might not deserve something that harsh, and I think that you just need to be resilient with it.
Right.
And, I mean, you can't let it affect you, and you just have to not let that... You can't dwell on that kind of stuff.
One more bit of advice. You get your evaluation here anyway. You get your evaluations basically. I think you get some sort of mid clerkship evaluation. Mm-hmm. And then 6 weeks after your clerkship is done, I think they turn in a grade. And I think at that point, maybe you get your all of your sort of written evaluations. I don't think they have to turn it in before that. So that's kind of a problem. In that the clerkship's already over, you've already moved on to other things. I think it's probably important to go back and look at the totality of the, continue to look back at the totality of evaluations you've received, the comments you've received. Those may or may not end up in your MSPE, especially if there's a pattern of like negative comments. But if there's a pattern, then that might end up in it. What I routinely see is people who come in and they're like, oh my God, I had no idea how good I look on paper. Or, oh my God, I had no idea how bad I look on paper. And my guess is that's because they never go back and look at the totality of their evaluations to see the pattern, and they can't correct it if they need to correct it.
And that sounds like, you know, you're systematically missing out on a great deal of the education, because that's part of, I mean, a lot of this is sort of a trial and error process, right? And that's how most learning goes, is you kind of see, okay, this is working or this isn't working. I need to adapt a little bit, change what I'm doing and adjust it to something else. So if you're not really getting that feedback, then how do you know, what
that's
you're doing?
Well, that's the thing. They're getting the feedback maybe, but they're not getting it in a way that's incredibly, that allows you to summarize what's going on.
I think that would be help with that sort of resiliency. It was mentioned earlier that like, if you see a pattern of good comments and then you get one bad comment and you're really down on yourself and you just remember, okay, well, everybody else liked me. Maybe I'm just not good at this routine. I'm not good at surgery or something. Or this guy just really didn't like me. Like, that to me is a lot easier to feel like that's really just, okay, that guy didn't like me, if I have a bunch of like old ones that I could look at and say, that's good, I did good.
The one problem with my advice, though, is that if it were me and I got like 10 great comments and one bad one, I'd be like, oh, I'm such an idiot.
That's what I'm saying, though.
No, that's probably true.
You can't dwell on those
things. That's probably true.
I want to distill what Mark said into an aphorism that you can, put in your back pocket. And
an
that
aphorism,
is
aphorism, ladies and gentlemen.
A witty aphorism. No. Here we go. The key is to strike a balance between taking it seriously or not taking it personally and not taking it seriously. So that is to say, you don't want to take it personally and then have it, ruin your day. Now you're snide. You feel like they're out to get you. But you also don't want to be that person who's like, well, this guy's just an asshole.
Yeah, definitely.
Because then you're really missing out on an opportunity to go, hey, I'm not actually a very good listener.
Mm-hmm.
Or, hey, I have a tendency to, reinterpret what I'm told and do it slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
So taking that, striking a balance between not taking it personally and not taking it seriously.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I don't know if your aphorism there is going to put waste not want not out of business, but it's good.
It's a little wordy.
It's good advice.
that's
like, you couldn't put it on a t-shirt, for example.
Strike a balance between not taking it personally and not taking it seriously.
There you go.
That's not that bad.
Okay, that's pretty good.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back on the Short Code Podcast.
The Art of Medicine Podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
Mount Sinai, and reading about Mount Sinai in on NPR, they apparently have a program where in the second year they will admit you into medical school. I assume if you have awesome grades, but if you are a liberal arts major. So right in your second year, they will just guarantee you admission. Second year of college. Just admit you into the ICANN, Mount Sinai College of Medicine.
What do they include in liberal arts? Because if the goal is to increase students who have studied humanities, right?
Yeah. So,
because biology and physics and stuff, at least at Iowa State, were also considered liberal arts. So that's not really...
So
that doesn't seem to be forwarding their goal.
They want things like what they've listed here is things like English or history, medieval studies. I think what they're looking for is things that aren't traditionally sciency, right? Or not thought of as traditionally sciency. The goal being to create or to induct students who are, you know, sort of already on the path towards being, they're not so focused on science that they are, you know, perhaps going to be incapable of being a well-rounded physician when the time comes for them to graduate. What do we think of this idea?
So you said they recently expanded it, right?
Yeah. So
they said it was a success.
So
in terms of applicants?
I think so. So this all came out in the 80s, late 80s. Mm-hmm. There was sort of a perception that medical students were too focused on grades, too focused on you know, scores and things like that. I think this will sound pretty familiar.
LOL, what?
Still sound pretty familiar to most of us.
Science topics too.
Yeah. So, but you know, to the exclusion of some of the other things that might make somebody a, you know, well-rounded humanistic physician. So
the question, the question then is, how are they evaluating these students in the humanities to ensure that they can still be successful in an environment such as medical school? Because writing a research paper in English, for example, requires a set of skills that you don't, they're applicable within the medical field, but you don't get to apply them too often, at least in your first 2 years of medical school.
That's a good question. I'm not really sure it's addressed here in particular.
Well, you said they're doing like a summer component. So once you get accepted into the program, then you go take a bunch of basic sciences classes over the summer.
Yeah, so they give you
or something, and then they know that you have the prerequisite knowledge that you need
to get through. Idea.
They give you this support. So if you've never taken, you know, biology, they'll give you the information you need over the summers. I would assume so. That
maybe
sort
not
of
if
makes...
you take them during the year. Maybe you can opt out, but a lot of people wouldn't have time if you have a totally different major. You know,
I think it's a cute idea,
Mount Sinai, how cute!
But here's what's going to happen: people are going to game the system. If you were to drop in and all of a sudden be like, for the next year, we will accept people who are already in medieval studies, etc. Right, but.
My mom calling.
Oh, okay.
Shall I get it?
Hi, Dave's mom.
Mom, you're on the show.
Hang on.
So,
she's calling to ask me a computer question, I guarantee you.
People are going to game it. And then they're not going to be engaged in those, you know, first 2 years anyway. They're going to be like, oh, this just lets me get into medical school 2 years earlier.
Well, hopefully that means that they wouldn't actually be any good at it. But they aren't getting in 2 years earlier, right?
They're not getting in. They're not starting medical school 2 years earlier. They are they're guaranteed acceptance. And I'm assuming that means that they have to maintain a certain standard, you know, in terms of, you know, effort and grades and all that kind of stuff. And then they are supplementally taking science classes that will prepare them for medical school. I don't know if that changes what you're
I mean, it doesn't change how I feel about it. I think it's a really great idea, and I think the better, I mean, in concept, in theory, but I think the application of it is what's going to happen is people are going to go, oh, I want guaranteed acceptance to medical school. I didn't know what I was going to major in anyway, so I might as well major in English now.
So what I'm,
Weird game. All of this is all a weird game that you have to play. And I think this is something I wanted to echo that Keenan did say, like, I think it's really ridiculous that now in order to get into medicine, you need to know in high school. You know, and you're like, okay, I'm a high school student trying to get into someone's research lab. Like, really? Why don't we encourage, I think the better way to do it is to go the other way around and say, we're not letting anyone into medical school under the age of 25.
Well,
go
that,
live your life. Go make some mistakes. Go figure out what you want to do with your life. And I'm not to point any fingers at anyone in specific, but
young
I think
eyebrows raised.
But I think it's easier. I think it's easier for people to go, hey, I'm going to go do this thing, and then I'm going to do the next thing, and then the next thing, and the next thing is just medical school. Than it is to try to like go out into the world and figure out what they want to do with their life. And again, this isn't, you know, this doesn't apply to everyone, but you know, I think there are a significant number of people who have, by my experience that I've seen, that are making decisions that I think they will feel differently about in with greater perspective on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think an interesting other take on the Mount Sinai program is I wonder if the rates of these students dropping out will be any higher, because these are people who have had such exposure to other things. And I mean, you could argue that it's not necessarily what you study in college that makes you a more humanistic, well-rounded doctor as much as it's what the training does to you that squashes out a lot of that intrinsic, other hobbies, other things you're interested in. I mean, is the problem that these kids coming in aren't well-rounded enough, or is it the problem that the medical system is making people less rounded, more focused in which case it really isn't addressing the root problem?
I think there's a little bit of both going on. You get people who are pretty well-rounded who, you know, a handful of them manage to scrape through, but they usually don't end up pursuing those things that they really enjoy that make them well-rounded during medical school and residency years. And that is a problem in and of itself. But then I do think we also have sort of a self-selection process where the people who are the most focused, who are the most going to get the most extreme crazy MCAT scores and the most extreme crazy grades and... like they're going to be historically more prone to get into medical school. Now, I think there's a big shift away from that with trying to include like leadership and extracurriculars and volunteering and other things like that. And I like that. I think that's good, because if you have that reserve of things that you like to do and you know how to be busy and balance the schedule while you're busy and also doing things that you enjoy, that's going to help. So I think it's targeting people who are more likely to be naturally well-rounded, who are more likely to naturally move towards one of those humanities programs.
And then I just wonder if those people are also much more susceptible to really doubting their choice once they start to get those things that they've made so central to their identity really taken away, because there's a lot of sacrifices you need to make through the training.
Yeah, and you don't know. Like when you're a sophomore in college,
you
have
really
no
can't even explain
idea
it to someone.
Like you can say that you can sort of know intellectually, oh yes, I will work hard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you don't know.
I'm willing to give X up. You can't, it's hard to say that until you actually have to.
So, okay. What bothers me about this, I say this as, I have an English degree and chose after college to pursue medicine. But what bothers me is the implication then that somebody who majored in biochemical engineering, who has a 4.0, who has, you know, an insanely high MCAT, that the implication is that that person is not well-rounded. Mm. And I haven't really seen much evidence that that is true. You meet a lot of these people who sort of fit this mold of, you know, you see their stats on paper and you think, oh, man, this guy's going to be pretty stiff.
So
and
what if
you find out that they're not? Like, they're just as dynamic as...
But so what if, to combine John's thought and your thought, is, you know, so John said, you know, I'd be worried about people gaming the system. And your thought is, well, you know, people who studied biochemistry may in fact be perfectly well-rounded people. So if John's people are like, okay, I'm going to game the system by taking, you know, English, even though I'd rather take biochemistry. Doesn't that, though, mean that they will then, you know, sort of become, they might then become the best of both
maybe
those worlds?
You know, here's what I would like to see. And if I was on an admissions committee and someone gave me all the power, here's what I would do. I would take a section of each class at a good number so that you could get some real data on them. And I would, we would pre-filter so that we believed that all of these candidates are qualified, like will actually be able to survive it.
They will be capable.
And then we pick randomly. And we don't pretend like we know how to pick better than otherwise. Because, you know, there's a really beautiful series of writings about, I think it was, I can't remember if it was Daniel Kahneman or Martin Seligman was talking about being, it was Martin Seligman, or Daniel Kahneman was tasked with trying to find a better way to pick officers for the military than just looking at their aptitude scores.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and using aptitude scores and using these team-based interactions and stuff like that, they had this great system, and it was a complete crapshoot. They thought that they were really good at picking good officers, but they were really terrible at picking good officers. And it was just like people think they're good at picking stocks, but they're not better than the market at picking stocks. And so, you know, I think it echoes really well, like the really insightful things that Casey and Nick had to say. Like, you know, you could see this guy on paper and be like, oh, this guy's stiff as a board. You know, he's going to be really dry, really, you know, really single-mindedly, narrowly focused, and find out that, you know, this is a really giving person, really caring, really interested in, you know, very diverse sets of things that people, you know, do. And I think that's, I think that would be very interesting.
Isn't perhaps that- they should do interviews in a bar with just a pitcher of beer. One pitcher, you know, don't go crazy. One pitcher of beer.
There's a skit by these British comedians.
It'd tell you a lot, though.
That's what I'm thinking.
It would tell you a lot. Well, no, it's like the whole skit is like a joke that you function best on like a glass and a half of wine. Mm. You cannot drink more than a glass and a half. Like, well, and they have this whole like cult built around like good business functionality.
Regardless of size, regardless of gender, regardless of ethnic background.
Future surgeons of
the
world.
Well, they were all white males, so don't worry about it.
1.5 glasses of wine before surgery.
Yeah. Well,
they were businessmen, so.
Yeah, well, business is a different game than surgery.
No, it's more fun to insinuate this.
But yeah, no, the idea of like, I get what you're saying about like the pick out a pre-selected group that you think is going to do good and then select from them. But to me, even if our choosing system is imperfect, that feels very fundamentally unjust, that you could work so hard and be really excellent and maybe actually a better candidate, and then just because of the crapshoot, bad luck.
It's already like that and worse, because we pretend that the reasons we pick people for this are the right reasons, and they may or may not be. But if they're not, think about it. You know, it's sort of the question you ask yourself about, you know, the risk of wrongfully imprisoning someone. If there is a chance that what we're doing is not the right way, then you've really done it wrong. Because imagine people who would be very good at the nature of medicine, who'd be very caring, who'd be very interested in listening and working with people and working as a team, and are very fluid thinkers and are good at being humble. All the things that we are pretty sure make for a good physician, I don't see any of those being selected for in the process of getting into medical school. I see, for the most part, this sort of cutthroat GPA achievement. I see, you know, mostly what we're really caring about is high MCAT scores. Mm-hmm. And I don't see those being, I see the correlation coefficient being zero.
Well, haven't they looked at
between those factors? Wait, you see it, but that's not what the data says, at least for MCAT.
So another change, some schools have started adopting what is called the MMI, the multiple mini interview, and that's mm-hmm. a series of, you end up, instead of showing up for one interview, one 30-minute interview, which is what we do at Iowa, you show up and do something like 10-minute interviews. Mm-hmm. And they do this at OHSU. So I did this at OHSU, which is Oregon's medical school. And the idea is that each interview, you have a prompt on the outside the door. You get buzzed in. You go in, and sometimes it's a scenario. There's an actor who you have to, you know, they're upset about something, and you just have to walk into this room, and someone's evaluating you, and you have to make this actor feel better. Yeah. And then others are, you're just answering a question. And so it's, the idea is that with 10 different interviews and 10 different people, evaluating you, that you get a better holistic sense of the applicant.
So you did this. You took.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Was it more or less stressful?
This sounds terrifying.
Yeah, it did. It sounded awful. I was terrified going into it. The very first interview. So the first interview also was, my first interview was a prompt where a disease has wiped out the world. There's 10 people, on this list, and I have to choose 3 of them to save. That was the prompt. And when I went in, the person doing the interview was a 4th-year medical student, and it did not help that she was also very attractive. So I'm nervous.
All intentional.
I'm going to say you.
Okay, we need somebody really attractive for this one to freak them right out.
So I'm already nervous and explaining to this woman who's also like my age, and explaining to her like how I would create this harem, essentially, to like repopulate the world.
So how'd that go over?
And she's challenging each of my picks. Yeah. Because one of my people that I saved among these 10 was a stripper, and my reasoning was that presumably they are athletic, you know, they're fit.
No, that makes sense.
And so in the post-apocalyptic world, you know, that I want.
And they don't mind
fit.
Getting naked, which I appreciate.
Right.
As will humanity.
Yes. So very different from, you know, my interview at Iowa.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't talk about strippers at all in my interview in Iowa. Yeah. So.
I did.
That's good. No,
I mean, if anybody would.
Did Maybe. You, I don't know, you can tell me if I should edit this out. Did you get in?
No. I got waitlisted at Oregon, and so they, you know, they made my decision pretty easy.
Did you ask why?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because
I've
always wondered of what that evaluation said. I've always wondered about that one in particular.
This is
you're gonna run
this
into
really,
that girl someday, you'll have to ask her. Yep. She'll be like, "I don't remember you at all."
Yeah,
she'll remember every detail.
It was my first interview too, and this really cute guy came in, and then he started talking about strippers, and
you
I didn't know
to
what
make
to
this
do.
Weird harem.
There's an engineering firm, and the guy had decided, you know, I was unable to pick good candidates based on people's CVs or people's resumes. So he came up with this new idea, and what he did is they were doing very, very technical problem-solving engineering, and so he had this giant box, and he had 40 items in the box. And they were all very diverse engineering, certain kinds of valves and weird antenna, like weird Soviet radio antennas that are collapsible. And so you could have zero probability to expect that somebody would know what all of these things were. And they would, the interview would, you'd come in, they'd slide this thing across the table at you and have you open it up and say, "There are 40 items in there. I want you to explain to me what they're used for, what you would use them for, how you would solve problems with them, and go."
Oh, I love that.
And
that's fun.
That sounds really fun.
And he said, "You know what? This was much better because I could get somebody with an undergraduate degree in engineering who is 6 to 10 times better at doing the job than somebody who had a PhD in engineering in the equivalent field, because this was what I was really doing, is finding the metrics that I cared about and figuring out a way to hone in on them."
And that's brilliant. Because you might not be right, but you know, on an individual item, but the way that you thought about it and
it's much more revealing
and explained it, and that's really good. Hey, we're just about out of time.
I know.
Aww. Listeners, I'm sorry, we have to go, but thank you guys, girls, ladies, women. Ooh. Sorry.
Represent.
I don't know. What am I supposed to
say?
All
of them here?
Yes. Bye.
People, human beings.
If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, please go to shortcode.com and leave us some sort of message. We'd love to play your thoughts on the air. Even if you hated what we have to say, I guarantee you we will talk about it. Even if you hated what John had to say. Especially if you hated what John had to say. The Shortcode Podcast is made possible by a generous donation from the Carver College of Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our theme music is by, I don't even know. I forgot to write it down again. Our opening theme music is by Dr. Vox. Our closing theme music is by C2C. We'll talk to you in 1 week.
Our weird disease of the week is fibroadenoma, also known lovingly by surgeons as breast mouse, known lovingly to me as tit mouse, because
there is such a thing.
Because it is a mobile lump in your breast, and surgeons complain about it because you kind of have to chase it around to get it if you're trying to surgically extract it.
I have to ask, it's not moving of its own volition, I hope.
I hope not.
It just moves when you touch it.
It just sort of slides around, I think. Like, you can feel it as described as a mobile lesion or mobile mass.
Fantastic. Titmouse, thank you.